This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Kevin Fitzpatrick is a historian best known for his writings on Dorothy Parker and joins us on the program. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Kevin, part of that lyric is that if Dorothy Parker was still alive, she'd be a friend of mine. Would she be a friend of yours, do you think, if she was still alive?
I think so. I live in the same neighborhood she did, the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and I love gin, I love scotch, and I love writing and books, so I think we get along.
What was it about her that has made her so infamous or famous, for, especially around New York, but also around the world?
I think she was a woman ahead of her time. She was political, and she was very smart, very funny, and she was a fantastic writer, and she's never gone out of print. So I think that's why people are still talking about her almost 50 years after she passed away.
Because, I mean, when you look at it, we're talking about the late 1800s and through to the early 1960s, well, the mid-1960s that she was alive. And this was an exciting time for people who wanted to be a bit different and speak out.
It was. I mean, she was running around New York with, you know, Fitzgerald and Hemingway and, you know, all the titans of New York society. You know, she helped start the New Yorker magazine. But it was also a very political time, you know, between the two world wars. And so she and her friends were right in the thick of it.
Was she brought up with politically active parents, or was this something that came about from herself?
A lot of writers in New York and America in that time became radical. You know, this is before the American Depression. There was a lot of, you know, labor. There was labor movement was very big here. We had a lot of economic stress at the time. So a lot of the rise of the political unhappiness came out of that time, and a lot of writers joined that. But as far as her father was an upper middle class clothing manufacturer, and so she really, you know, didn't want for anything really growing up. But she did see her father. She would accompany him down to the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which is the immigrant section of the city, and she would go and see the people that worked in the sweatshops that worked for her father, and so she was exposed to that at a very young age.
Her mother died when she was quite young, didn't she?
Yes, her mother died not too long before she turned 5 years old, and then she got a stepmother, and her stepmother passed away when she was 9. So she really didn't have a mother influence in her life.
Did she talk about that later in life and that, if that affected her or not?
Not so much. I mean, she made light of it, and she liked to tell people that she was an orphan, even though her father died when she was 20. As far as, have, you know, there was a lot of characters in her books of, you know, bad moms or, you know, unhappy society women, and so that might have played out of, you know, her upbringing.
If her father was the dominant parent in her life, did she have a good relationship with him?
She did, and what happened is she was the youngest of four, and after her siblings moved out of the house, she kind of became the caretaker. She quit school when she was 13 and, you know, never went back to school, and so she lived with her dad, the two of them, and she took care of him until he passed away.
So she was quite a compassionate woman.
I think so. I mean, she had a lot of loves. She had two husbands, you know, I think it mostly manifested in her dogs. She was a big dog lover, and so she was very compassionate about her dogs. But she gave a lot of time to left-wing causes, a lot of time to social justice causes, and so I think she had a big heart.
But she was also recognized as being a woman that you didn't cross, and that she'll be quite acerbic with her wit as well.
She had a very sharp wit, and as a critic, you know, first in Vanity Fair and then in other magazines, she really made her bones as a critic and, you know, putting people in her place, you know, first as a theater critic and then in books, book reviews, you know, and writing, you know, short fiction and poetry and in that way.
So when you mentioned that she was quite a compassionate woman, was she not recognized for that compassion later?
It's hard to say because, you know, she wasn't making, you know, newspaper headlines for being a compassionate person.
Yes.
She would get in the newspaper for speaking out at you know, anti-government protests or at, you know, left-wing causes or to raise money for, you know, Spanish Civil War. you know, that would get her name in the newspaper, but that wasn't really a cause for saying, hey, Dorothy Parker is a big-hearted person.
As a girl that left school at the age of 13, how did she find herself writing and to be part of magazines?
Sure. Good question. She and her dad would write poems back and forth to each other, starting when she was very young. When she was at summer camp or away with her sister on vacations, she and her dad would exchange long, long letters and poems back and forth to each other. So she really grew up as a writing person, and she was a voracious reader, always surrounded by books. So at that time, you know, just by being self-taught, that really helped her. She went to a Catholic elementary school. Then she went to finishing school for around a year and a half, and that was the basis for, you know, launching herself. But I think it was really mostly self-taught.
Like, having gone to a finishing school, does that mean that she could then quite easily fit into social circles as well?
Yes, very much so. I mean, she knew a little French. She had good manners, you know, we would say good breeding. She basically talked her way into a job working for Condé Nast at a very young age just because she charmed the pants off of the boss, because she looked good, she sounded good, she came from a good family, and that was really because of, you know, she kind of had a nice upbringing.
So it's interesting, though, because she rebelled against that or spoke out against that, but she was still quite happy to be part of that. Or within that structure, were there a group of people that were also speaking out?
Well, that's funny because she makes mention of that. When she went to Madrid and witnessed the bombings, I mean, she was walking around these refugees with designer clothes on. And she said, you know, look at me. I look like the prize sow of West End Avenue with my big hat on and my fancy clothes. And, you know, she knew that. She knew that she looked, you know, ridiculous, you know, wearing clothes from Beverly Hills when she's in a war situation.
So although she recognized that, she was still happy to be part of it as well.
I think so. I mean, she wasn't going to turn down big checks from, you know, working on Hollywood screenplays just because, you know, they were coming from, you know, a rich corporation like a movie studio. She still identified with the common man and still managed to say, you know, some very nice things and really work for, you know, the underprivileged and minorities and people that were kind of left out of the greater society picture.
So she was really able to use her position to be able to do then the right thing by other communities.
Yes, and that goes back to the mid-20s, around 1927. She wrote a story for Vanity Fair called Arrangement in Black and White. And to read it, you know, Harold Ross thought it was just a funny story. But when you read it, it's really about social injustice, about two white women at a party talking about a black man, a singer, who is based on Paul Robeson, the great, you know, black singer actor of that era. Mm. And she was really talking about social injustice in the New Yorker, which was very, very white and very, very establishment at the time.
How was that received, though, from number one, from the New Yorker and also from the rest of the public? How did people see her?
Well, what that did is it kind of put her on a different footing. You know, that kind of, you know, radical Dorothy Parker, you know, she went to Boston with other members of the roundtable to protest the execution of anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti. She was arrested. And that really was one of her proudest moments, she said, is when she stood up for something and, you know, made herself known. But, you know, the New Yorker bought the story just because they thought it was a funny story. Not really reading between the lines. It was about, you know, racial intolerance and social justice.
Being a woman that speaks out, did that do her career, was it good for her career or bad for her career? Because it can work either way.
It was terrible. I have her FBI file. It's over an inch and a half thick. And, you know, J. Edgar Hoover was following around for 30 years. She ended up getting blacklisted. She was put on watch lists. She belonged to more than 30 left-wing organizations. And at the time in America, you know, around World War II, that was not a good thing. And so studios were not eager to help her. The New Yorker wanted her to write more funny stories, and she wanted to write serious things. And so she stopped being, you know, the funny poet, and she just really wanted to focus on, you know, writing serious stories or writing things that weren't, you know, ha-ha funny, but more cerebral.
So unlike nowadays where any publicity is good publicity, it didn't quite work that way then.
Well, it was a little bit different. You know, back then there was no internet. There was no way for a writer to, you know, get their word out except through, you know, mainstream newspapers or radio. So she could have been, and I think she could have been, you know, very well pigeonholed as, you know, the funny, you know, wit, where she really thought of herself as a very serious writer.
Owen, good morning.
Good morning again, Trevor, and greetings to your guest. My question is, I know I'm jumping a bit ahead of things, but then again, you're touching on some of what I want to discuss. I've read that when Dorothy Parker died, that she bequeathed her estate to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and it, so, and it subsequently, following his death, it passed on to the National Association of Colored People. I was wondering, I mean, it's one thing to be passionately involved in civil rights. It's quite another to lead your whole estate to the civil, dedicate your whole estate to the civil rights cause. And it did apparently cause quite a bit of contention. So I was wondering whether you could talk, your guest could, go a bit deeper into what the reasons why she did that, because it's quite a remarkable thing to do.
Kevin? I don't know if you heard, he was talking about the leaving of her estate to the civil rights movement.
Yes, I understood it perfectly. Well, think about the 1960s. Dr. King was probably in the newspaper every single day. You know, the civil rights movement was very, very important in American society at that time. So I could see why she would want to change her will and make him the recipient of her estate, which was only several thousand dollars at the time, but it was also all of her copyrights and royalties. And like I said, she'd been writing and thinking about social justice going back to the 1920s, so it wasn't that unusual. What was kind of interesting is when she passed away, she left her executrix, Lillian Hellman, to take care of her affairs. Hellman had her cremated but never claimed her body or never claimed the cremains, and so she remained in an urn in her lawyer's filing cabinet for more than 20 years.
God.
Until 1988, when the NAACP stepped in and claimed her remains and buried her in Baltimore. Because when Parker died in 1967, Martin Luther King was assassinated the following year, and so the estate passed on to them. So today, the Civil Rights Organization, which, you know, it's making news today in Ohio outside the Donald Trump, you know, rally, they're still around, and her money is still going to help this organization.
But does that mean that she didn't have people close to her in the end when she died, that could happen, that your urn could be left in a filing cabinet for 20 years?
Well, you know, she was 73 when she passed, and a lot of her good friends from the round table were already deceased. She had nieces and nephews, but she didn't, you know, decide to leave it to them. I think that she was just a kind of contrarian person that thought, you know, here's someone I never met, but I really respect him, and so I'm going to leave him my money. And that's what she did.
But it was more that you would care about her remains. That's the thing that I find interesting, that there wasn't anybody that bothered to go, well, we can't leave her there.
Yeah, that was Lillian Hellman. I mean, she was a horrible person, and it didn't come out for many years that no one had ever done anything with it. And so it wasn't until her biographer, Marion Mead, found out in the 80s that she had never gone to Woodlawn Cemetery with her parents. She was in a filing cabinet on Lower Broadway that action was taken.
We should talk about the Round Table, which was very significant to her life. Tell us exactly what it was and what they did.
Sure. Well, the Algonquin Hotel is on West 44th Street. And after the war, in 1919, when Alexander Wolcott, who was a drama critic for the Times, came back from the war, a group of friends had a welcome back to New York luncheon or roast for Wolcott. And who they invited were publicists, writers, columnists, newspaper men, publicity guys. And they had such a great time at that first get-together in June 1919. They said, well, why don't we do this again? And so they came back the next day and the next day. And so 6 days a week for about 7 or 8 years, this group met for lunch at the round table. And it was around 30 people, and men and women, and they collaborated on hit shows. They worked on things with each other, and it was very influential. Some of the members were George S. Kaufman, the playwright, Robert Benchley, the humorist, Edna Ferber, as a novelist. And so this group really kind of set the tone for New York at that time. He helped start the New Yorker in 1925. They worked on, you know, hit Broadway shows like Dinner at Eight and The Royal Family. And, you know, they even got into, you know, later into, you know, talking pictures, and some were around long enough for, you know, live television in the 1950s. So they really had a big mark on New York culture at the time.
How was that group put together, though? I mean, because I presume there were a heck of a lot of publicists, a heck of a lot of people that were writing, and a heck of a lot of actors and actresses. Why did the whoever it was put that group together choose that group of people? Because it was the like-mindedness?
Sure. Well, it was Alexander Wolcott, who was a very acerbic critic for the Times, and he decided, like Nero, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down. No one could just barge in. You had to be invited. And once you're invited, he would kind of decide if you could stay at the table. And yeah, it was very competitive that way. But really, what got them a lot of publicity very quickly is there's so many columnists, and so they needed, you know, copy on a regular basis. So they could just say, what did Dorothy Parker say at the roundtable today, or what did Robert Benchley say? So it was repeated in the newspaper, and then it would get picked up by the wire services, and soon it'd be coast to coast very quickly.
Do we forget now that critics at that time were very powerful?
Well, back then, you know, the daily newspaper circulation of, you know, the New York Tribune and the New York World could be 2 million. And there would be both morning and afternoon papers. You know, you would get your morning paper for what happened the night before, and then at 4 o'clock, the afternoon paper would tell you what had happened during the day. So, and everybody was such a voracious, you know, reader that they had a lot more say.
Because it's interesting when you take a look at that group at the round table. There are the ones that meet continuously, but then there were people that would come in and out of that group as well.
Right, like Edna Ferber, probably most known today for writing Giant, which is James Dean's last great film. She would only go, you know, once a week or maybe every couple of months because she was always writing. She couldn't afford to go to the hotel 6 days a week and waste 2 hours of time. She had to, you know, pay the bills, and so she was always at her typewriter. She would only go down there when, you know, she made a big deadline. So not everybody was there quite as much as some of the others.
Because as I read through the people that were there, people like Harpo Marx was there, Noel Coward was there. So there are some people there that not only could pull their weight in sorts of ways, but also, again, very witty and clever people.
Yes, and that's really was the hallmark. I mean, you needed to be funny, and you needed to be, you know, a really sharp character and have sharp elbows too to sit at that group.
So what came about as a result of that round table group?
Well, there would be no New Yorker magazine without them, because Harold Ross, who started the magazine, was a real non-entity in New York. He was very very much a newcomer to the city, so he relied on his friends at the round table to help it get going. And Dorothy Parker was in the very first issue in 1925. Ferber kicked in stories. Franklin P. Adams, you know, wrote for him. So they really helped to get it off the ground, and we would not have that magazine today without that group. There's that, and then they collaborated on a lot of shows. Some of the members went on to, you know, great things they learned that time. Herman Mankiewicz was a screenwriter member who wrote Citizen Kane, and that's based on his experience in New York in the 20s on a newspaper. So all of those kind of, you know, pop culture kind of references all came out of that era.
What was her personal life like? Did she married, have kids? What was her personal life like?
It was very messy. She got married, you know, when she was 21 to a stockbroker who promptly enlisted in the American Army and went over to World War I. When he came back, they split up not too long after that. She had a series of bad boyfriends. She had a couple of suicide attempts, an abortion. But really, all of that changed in 1932 when she met her second husband, who was a much younger man named Alan Campbell. And they lived pretty much happily on and off for the rest of her life. He was very supportive of her, really took care of her. He was her bartender. He was her, you know, chef, and, you know, did everything for her. So that was really, you know, her personal life. She never had children. She had nieces and nephews that she really, you know, cared a lot about. But not enough to leave any money in her will. But she had a lot of friends, as you know.
Was her sexuality questioned about whether or not she was bisexual, whether or not that was an important issue or not? Was that important to her?
I don't think so. I've never come across in 20 years of research anything to suggest that she was anything more than straight.
Yep.
She liked younger, good-looking, hunky guys that were kind of stupid. you know, one of her most famous quotes is, "I only require three things of a man. He must be handsome, ruthless, and stupid." So, yeah, most of her boyfriends and definitely her husband were of that ilk.
There have also been questions asked about her, because around that time there was a fair degree of anti-Semitism and whether or not that affected her in her life.
Well, it's funny because her father was Jewish and her mother was Protestant. And one day at the roundtable, Alexander Wolcott said to Georges Coffin, you know, he called him a Christ killer. And Coffin said, I'm done. I'm walking out of this hotel. And I think Dorothy Parker would walk out halfway with me.
Halfway. did that affect her career, or did she consider that to be an issue to her, or was it just didn't really mean anything?
She never really identified with being Jewish, and it was only later during World War II when she joined the anti-fascist and anti-Nazi leagues, and when she really started speaking up about the rise of fascism, and she gave money and time to refugee causes and, you know, helping out, you know, like refugee children and things like that. So that was really the only time that she ever really paid any attention to any kind of religious identity.
You talked about her FBI file and the fact that she was blacklisted. Tell us about that blacklisting and some of the things that were in that file and if that actually affected her life and her career as well.
It did. Hoover was following around a lot of writers. You know, the government was obsessed with screenwriters putting, you know, influence into movies at the time. They spent an incredible amount of money, you know, trying to crack the Hollywood propaganda machine, or, you know, finding things in movies. What it says in her FBI file is they were tracking, you know, the group she went to, the meeting she went to, who she spoke to. And one of my favorite things is two FBI agents went to her apartment and they were interviewing her, and her dogs were running around her apartment. And she said, "Listen, I can't even control these two. Do you think I can overthrow the government?"
And it was decided no.
No, no. But she was called to testify. She had nothing to say. And, you know, she was never asked to name names. But, you know, she really believed in social justice. And I think that's what really got to Hoover, is all these writers that were, you know, extremely liberal.
What were the causes that she was involved with most?
Most of them had to do with like Spanish war relief, or aiding, you know, people that are accused of crimes. At the time, there was a lot of injustice in the courts. There's a famous case called the Scottsboro Boys. They were boys accused of rape in the Deep South, and so she raised money for them and spoke out on their behalf. So a lot of, you know, those kind of 1930s causes, including the biggest, which is the Spanish Civil War. I mean, she went to Spain with Hemingway to see firsthand the devastation, and then she wrote about that and helped raise money for that, you know, back in America.
Was she pivotal to the round table? Because we talked about the heavyweights that were there and the roles that they played. And as a strong woman at that time, was she respected in her place at that table?
Well, you know, she kind of looked down her nose at it years later and, you know, kind of made light of the situation. But the fact is, her very best friends were there every day. And unless you wanted to eat lunch alone, you didn't go. So she held her own. I mean, she was there with, you know, some of the smartest people in the city. You know, aside from Kaufman, there was, you know, Robert E. Sherwood and Haywood Broun. These were all people that had, you know, very big followings in the newspapers and in the media at the time, and she was very close to them.
Did that, when the group broke up, was that because of conflict within the group, or was it just a natural progression that it broke up when people just went their own way?
It was a couple of things. It was a natural progression, but a lot of them went west to Hollywood when Talking Pictures came in 27, because Hollywood was taking all the New York writers out west to write for the movies. So several of them went west. But, you know, quite a few of them became, you know, very popular or had to work on other projects and things. So they couldn't really afford, you know, that kind of time. And certainly by the time the stock market crashed in America in 1929, it was over with.
These are very big personalities as well. There must have been conflict within that group too.
Oh, of course. You know, there's a lot of backbiting, and there was, you know, people that didn't get along. You know, Wolcott and Ferber, were constantly bickering. Wolcott had a falling out with Ross, years later. They didn't speak. So, you get a group of 30 type A personalities, there's definitely going to be some people getting rubbed the wrong way.
Did she have problems with alcohol or drug abuse within her time?
A lot of them drank heavily. She did live to 73, and she was a lifetime, chain smoker and loved her booze. She was a functioning alcoholic. Others of that time, such as Robert Benchley, who died of cirrhosis of the liver, and were in much worse shape than she was. But she seemed to have outlived just about everybody. So her drinking couldn't have been that bad.
Did she? 73 was a pretty good innings for that time. Was she continuously productive up until she died?
She was. What happened is, in the 50s and 60s, she wrote book reviews for Esquire. She wrote short stories and occasional magazine pieces. So she did keep her hand in, well into her 70s. Esquire would send her, stacks of books, and she would turn in a column when she was able to. So she still did stay busy.
After death, do you think that she's been recognized as much as she should be after death? Because you see her talked about in films. She's still spoken of fondly in a lot of ways as being a strong character and a strong female character and a role model in a lot of ways.
There, not a week goes by that there's not some reference to her in pop culture. And today, there's more of her work in print than when she died 50 years ago. All of her poetry, her short stories, her drama reviews, and Dorothy Parker Complete Broadway, all of those are back in print. So there's really more of her words are out there now. And I think part of that is because she's not ephemeral. She's kind of timeless, writing about, getting her heart broken in 1929 is the same as it is in 2016. So all of those things, translate across the ages. Just in the last few months, there's been a production of her work in Brazil. There was a film just made in Paris. So her work is still continuing to be read, and she's still continuing to have, some kind of pull for folks.
And I would presume that that's what she would have wanted, that with her work, she would be very pleased that it's still relevant today. Did she see herself as being ahead of her time?
I don't think so. She really looked at writing as kind of a trade, like a bricklayer or a plumber or a builder. She looked at what she was doing as just work. She was very dismissive of her talent. She never put herself on a pedestal. She never considered herself an artist. She looked at herself just as a worker, and her work was putting words on the page.
And that recognition, do you think that she's been given the recognition that she deserves now from other critics and from other writers?
There's been some very nice things. Christopher Hitchens wrote, a fantastic appraisal of her life. She was just in the New York Review a couple of months ago, a very nice piece about her as a writer. She went to the Academy of Arts and Letters in New York, and she went to the New York State Writers Hall of Fame as a writer, not as a joke teller or a drinker. She's recognized for her writing. And I think that's, I think that's what her legacy will be. It's fun to see her on the internet and, see these funny quotes and things. But that just, I think, leads people to then want to pick up her books and find out more about her.
And the fact that she has been influential for modern writers today?
Oh, I see her definitely influenced people, such as, David Sedaris and other humor writers and Nora Ephron. Flat out came out and said it, said, I wanted to be Dorothy Parker. And, Nora Ephron is one of her, greatest screenwriters the last 25 years. So I think that's, a testament to Parker's power.
Kevin, it's been a pleasure talking to you about Dorothy Parker this morning. Thank you very much.
You forgot what Dorothy Parker said about Australia. She said, I was the toast of two continents, Greenland and Australia.
Thank you very much. Kevin Parker, the author of A Journey into Dorothy Parker's New York. This is Overnights.